Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle, this is The Schwepp, and today we're speaking with Jonathan Young, currently finishing his PhD, or his DPhil in Theology and Religion at the University of Oxford, and a man who knows a thing or two about reincarnationism in early Christianity. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. We're here today to talk about one of the greats, Origen or Origenes of Alexandria. And Origen is one of these figures that just is like a towering titan in the history of the intellectual history of Christianity. He's also fascinating to us because he is deeply esoteric in so many ways, as well as embracing the pastoral duty of a Christian preacher and you know, the sort of openness of Christianity. On the one hand, he also has a very much an esoteric thing going on, a deeper thing going on. And it was believed by some in antiquity that one of his more esoteric teachings was serial reincarnation, which would later become one of the many things that were condemned at various church councils as Originist heresy. Let's talk about Origen. Does Origen teach reincarnation? What's our evidence?
Well, the evidence as we have it, the scholarly consensus as it is now, is that in stark contrast to what later people say, Origen, as the evidence shows, does not actually believe in reincarnation, and at least in my view. But he talks about it a lot. And I think this is where the issue really arises, is the different terms of the debates that are going on during Origen's time generally allow for more discussion of these topics than in later tradition. And I think that Origen himself, the issue is he talks about it in multiple places across his works, and entertains the thought in a very scholarly way. But unlike other philosophical thinkers, he does not necessarily on all matters pin down a final answer.
Right.
And I think that's the issue that always frustrates not only the readers of antiquity, but even to scholars today. Sometimes the fact that he doesn't fully give the final answer sometimes to what we'd like to hear. But often, as is the case, if we look at other places within his writings, or even some of those other evidence about his writings, we can kind of test out whether or not he believes some of these ideas. Belief being a very broad thing, or whether or not he writes it down and at least puts it in writing.
Right. The question as to whether he is in line with that methodology of discussing ideas but leaving them open, whether he is, as someone has called him, a research theologian, and he realizes that there are some truths that we can all assent to, but there are others that we just don't know. Maybe we don't know yet, or maybe we'll never know them. And that's what we're doing. As one of the things we're doing as Christians is exploring these things. So to me, that's a very good reading of the On First Principles. Like he's playing with a kind of metaphysical ideas and creating a Christian metaphysics, but are we to take that this is his final word, that he would say, this is how the universe is for sure? That's not how I see it. I think it's much more like it's a creative and exploratory exploration of the territory of metaphysics through Christian scripture and ideas, and, you know, trying to create a map, but maybe not a complete map, open to revision. Is that your reading as well?
Exactly. It is. So I particularly look into Origen's discussion of how animals fit into this picture.
Right.
Which, as listeners will probably be aware, the question of reincarnation, or if we want to call it transmigration, there are many different words.
Metempsychosis.
Metempsychosis.
Metempsomatosis. you name it.
Metensomatosis is the word that Origen generally prefers in the Greek. Or sometimes you even have the discussion of the topic without a word itself mm-hmm. describing it. With Origen, my reading is that he is very attuned to the idea that among the general common concept, common conception of what this thought entails, that animals are one of the central parts of this right. tenet. And as listeners will probably be aware, that's one of the big questions among Hellenic questioners or thinkers about the topic as well. With Origen, I think if we look at animals as a lens, we can kind of test out his thoughts.
Okay.
Specifically, because he's the most clear. He's the clearest on this point. He does not like the idea that animals are implicated in this scheme, that the human soul can become an animal, that the soul can go to an animal body, or that an animal soul can go to a human body, or that however way you phrase it, it's not what he likes. And in fact, one of the problems that we have with the evidence itself, so much of his work that was in Greek is just no longer in Greek.
Yeah.
And only survives within Latin translation, most of it by Rufinus in the 4th century.
Mm.
When we look at the Greek, specifically in Contra Celsum, he is without fail against the idea that the human soul or even the animal soul is involved within a reincarnation. So he will always speak against that as a process.
Does he come out really clearly against the human soul reincarnating strictly into humans, though? Because what you do see is he's going hard at Celsus and going like, this ridiculous idea that no Christian will ever believe that a human soul could become an animal is just foul and totally wrong, mm-hmm. right? Unambiguous, right? So he disagrees.
Yes.
And you can say, okay, like that means he rejects reincarnation, except we know for a fact that people like Iamblichus also felt the same way about this notion that
Absolutely.
You could literally become an animal.
My reading of the text is that the answer is that humans do not have reincarnation, according to Origen. The issue is that when he talks of, the big issue is that he talks about resurrection often in terms answering other charges that it's just a misunderstanding of transmigration. So he tries to reframe sometimes within Contra Celsum using transmigrational language
right.
to talk about reincarnation. But I don't think that he ever is thinking of it as a different body in the same sense as with a different sense, a different understanding, like in the Platonic sense of the fact that
yep.
you're not going to be aware of your continuity of self. So I think he would be very much on board with the fact that a Christian is going to have another body. If they're a good Christian, I guess. And that body will be in some way different from the current body that we have. But that doesn't necessarily mean a change in identity or necessarily that it's a different body in the same way.
That's
one example.
Okay, this is getting us into that Pauline resurrection body territory, which has exercised
yes.
Christians for so many millennia. You're going to be resurrected in your body by God at the time of the judgment. What does that mean? Like your body, like at what age is your body?
Yes.
What's it made of? Is it? And
yes.
I think it's clear that for Origen, this body will be noetic, right? Is that clear? Can we say that?
Not necessarily noetic, I would say. If we go with what he says in First Principles, he makes it clear that the body can, that the soul can never be disunited with a body.
From a body. So it always has to have a body.
It always has to have a body. It's just the question of what type of body. If we go based on what he says in Contra Celsum, he draws upon Paul's distinctions in the Pauline letters, asking about the type of spiritual body. So Paul talks about a spiritual body. So what Origen will often do is he goes based on what the text actually says in the scriptures, and that's generally his main approach, that if he has a question, he'll go back to the scriptures. What do the scriptures say? So in that sense, Origen will say that we will get another body, but that body will be in a different location. It'll be in the ethereal. It'll be an ethereal body that's suitable for the aether, being that's realm above the earth. That doesn't necessarily answer all of our questions because we don't know exactly where this is. Mm. Does it exactly map onto what we see in our present visual range? That's open and still open for a lot of different questions among scholars, exactly what he's meaning there. But he says there must be a change, that the body has to have a change, that you can't be in a different location and not have some change to match that location. But he doesn't say what it's going to be.
Mm.
And I think the issue there is, from what I've seen specifically, is that he uses language like transmigration, that his opponent that he's trying to argue against, Celsus, in the Against Celsus. We don't know anything really about Celsus except what Origen says about him. But he's a Platonist, second century. In the writing that he had, the Alethes Logos, the true word or true discourse, true discussion, he apparently wrote a lot about the question of transmigration as Plato expressed it. And so in that way, Origen is just using the terminology and the metaphors that his adversary has already supplied him with,
right,
just to continue the part of the book.
Yeah.
If we look elsewhere, especially with First Principles, and First Principles is one of those rare cases that we have some Greek fragments that have been preserved. Most of it's in Latin. Unfortunately, a lot of the Greek fragments that we have are not on this topic.
Not the good bit.
So, so we don't get to, we can't be as specific with wording as we would with other texts. And if we go again to the question of are animals presently embodied because they once were human? He entertains the question in First Principles, but tellingly, he immediately undercuts it and says, he makes it really clear, this is what some people say. And he himself says, this is a topic that is worth another book at another time. So that fits, I do believe, his general strategy of not revealing certain topics of the soul, as he himself says is his modus operandi, not to reveal these just plainly in writing here. Maybe he would have done it at another time. We just don't have it.
Yeah, or maybe Rufinus's translation of the On First Principles, which Rufinus admits he has Bodlerized. He doesn't say, I'm boulderizing this. He says, there are certain doctrines in here that were just beyond me. I just couldn't make sense of this. So I left those out. But what he's saying is, you know, if the Pope got wind of this, translated literally, he would be like, okay, ban this book. So I'm going to just gently massage it so that our Western brethren can drink from the springs of Origen's wisdom without maybe getting something too dangerous or whatever, too objectionable. We don't know what those doctrines were that he decided were beyond him.
We can kind of test how faithful Rufinus's translation is based on comparing it with the Greek passages. Mm-hmm. And generally my reading is that they're not too, it doesn't go so far as to explain, at least in certain cases that are, when we compare the Greek, there are translations that that Rufinus has made to allow Latin readers to be aware of Greek terminology that they would not have already known. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in that case, he is inserting. But we also find, and we can talk more about this a little bit later, but just to say right here, if we look at other evidence from around the same time, such as Pamphilus in his Apology for Origen, we see a similar restatement and a reiteration of the fact that Origen did not believe in the transmigration of the soul to animal bodies. But even then, let's just to put that into context, Rufinus is translating this as well. So the fact is, we really have Rufinus's word for it.
Yeah.
But I do think if we look at Contra Celsum specifically, we see Origen's words in Greek say a similar thing. Because in First Principles on this topic, he said, this is for another time, for another book.
Yeah.
In terms of what he says in the Greek and in against Celsus, when it comes to the question of the interpretation of the Tower of Babel and exactly what that entailed. Now, this doesn't have anything particularly to do with the question of reincarnation, but it has something to do with the soul. Mm-hmm. And on this particular point, Origen says, this is something we've introduced enough scriptural citation to explain what is being said in this passage. But that's enough of the topic for now for our discussion. So he gives places to look for in scripture to where a reader can find it, but he doesn't tell the reader what the definition is. So I think that's part of the problem.
That's the problem, or that's the, it's our problem.
And that's his solution.
if I may come at you with another interpretation of the evidence and see what you think before we turn to Origenism, so-called, because later on we are going to see Origen, although it's not always clear whether these anathemata, these church council condemnations of ideas, are with reference to Origen's actual writings or to a much larger tradition of people following Origen who are considered Origenists, right? But we are going to see Origen condemned both for teaching reincarnation, serial reincarnation, and for teaching that the resurrection body is going to be a spherical, sort of Platonic style spherical spiritual body. And many theologians will say Origen never taught those things, right? Many very prominent scholars of Origen. Now, let me put this to you. We know, and you have just given some classic examples of this, how Origen practices a certain form of esotericism, at least insofar as he practices the kind of writing just enough, not saying everything explicitly in written form. Mm-hmm. I think if you were an intimate student of Origen, you might have had a much different idea of what his teachings are than what he's willing to put on the page for general readership. And also, crucially, giving us evidence that that's what he's doing, like telling us. Not all things can be discussed openly, right? There are certain doctrines, especially to do with the soul, which must be treated with circumspection, a form of esoteric writing, a way of writing such that those who are, as it were, worthy, or those who have the hermeneutical tools, maybe, as in the case of the Tower of Babel, will be able to go to scripture, apply the originistic hermeneutic for themselves and go, aha, this is what this passage is telling us. But he's not going to come out and say it. He's not going to do the interpretation for everyone because mm-hmm. it's not for everyone, right? Esoteric writing. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's no reason to think he accepts animal reincarnation. Many people objected to it, but both within strict school Platonism and just in general. It's human beings, a human being, not an animal. Never the twain shall meet, right? So he rejects that. But the fact that he's going to say, Celsus, that's ridiculous that you think that, but not go ahead and just say, and it's also ridiculous that you think humans are going to reincarnate into other human bodies, which to me would be the logical next point. Mm-hmm. Like, no, we're going to die, and then we're going to be resurrected in this special resurrection body that is spherical or whatever. Even if he leaves the spherical part out, the point is it's a one-off thing in Christian orthodoxy, as it will develop later. The fact that he doesn't do that makes me, as a hypothetical, I'm creating a kind of a hypothetical reader of Origen that I want to present you with. Mm-hmm. This is Origen saying, you know, but human to human reincarnation does occur. So if that were Origen's teaching, the reason he doesn't write it down in his current form is A, because it's esoteric, B, because even maybe he did hint at it more, but those hints were potentially removed by Rufinus and maybe also removed by the fact that we don't have all his writings. All these later anathemata directed against him, those are genuine evidence for Origen's teachings. So that's I'm presenting you with that as mm-hmm. a thought experiment. What are your objections to that?
Well, my first objection is the fact that in light of not having what Origen specifically would say on the subject, I never want to try to put anything specifically said, any words in his mouth, so to speak, to say about the subject. But there again, logically, if we think about it, there is the tendency within scholarship, as with the pre-Socratics, we look at testimonia and we try to build cases for what did Empedocles believe, what did Xenophanes, infamously, how do we reconstruct the Pythagorean tenets of thought? So we use later testimonia to try to reconstruct what the original author had said. And we do this also with the junior contemporary of Porphyry with Origen. Porphyry himself, with this question, people have long questioned Porphyry's stance on this.
Yeah.
You can't pin it down for Porphyry. I think one thing that is useful for us as interpreters of the evidence is to not have a one-size-fits-all approach to what testimonia, what later evidence about a person's beliefs is, isn't, or does. Like, each person's work has a particular, pun intended, I guess, afterlife of readers in how they understand what was previously said. And I think in the case of Origen, we have to keep that in mind, just in general, kind of an open opinion of looking at what the evidence says without necessarily saying it's wrong, Origen didn't think this, yeah. or to say it's right Origen saw this and tried to find it. I think it's one to look at what Origen has said specifically and test each thing out itself. My reading to go at that directly would be to say there's enough of what Origen has written about that would certainly give an impression that matches like a watercolor painting to what later opponents accuse him of teaching. Later opponents will say that Origen had said that the humans had come from angels or even with demons, had said that Origen believed that the soul existed in a state prior to the body, as you've said, will become spherical. Even the thing about animal transmigration, that the soul will go to animal bodies. And some other things that they say against him have to do with particularly the relationship with Christ to God the Father, and some other questions such as that. When we think about it, we know that the thing about animals is not expressed by Origen. Mm. Yet, the fact is, if we look at one of the famous detractors, Jerome, for instance, another person in the 4th century, Jerome, I think, represents a difference in how the evidence, or how Origen is read. That just because you say something is at least presented by Jerome as the acceptance of the thought.
Jerome
and I think that's a big thing.
He is utterly uncharitable to Origen, and the impression he gives me is like one of those online debater type people that just want to, like, everything you say, twist it as far out of context and as much in the direction of something bad as you possibly can, in a way that's often even comes across as disingenuous. Like, Jerome, you don't actually believe he believes that, but you're saying you do. That's the impression I get. Do you know what I mean?
And it's hard because sometimes on other matters, let's say some of our primary evidence for the lost work of Origen's patchwork or his Stromatées comes from Jerome. Mm. And Jerome says, I'm quoting verbatim. Whether or not it's really a quotation verbatim is still up for scholarly discussion. But there again, the topics that Jerome says Origen brings up, Origen does bring them up and does talk about them. But Jerome's reading of it, he's saying, we shouldn't even hear this. This shouldn't even be a thing that we even discuss about the question. And none of this should even be talked about.
Right.
Origen's willing to talk about it. So I think in that essence right there, we see that the subject matter lines up with the accusations, or rather the accusations line up with the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But they don't necessarily show that Origen taught it.
Right.
In my view.
I'm with you.
Because when we even look at what he has said on the human body with reincarnation, we can look at Commentary on John, for instance. He looks at it and explores it, introduces it, but he doesn't endorse it.
Yep.
So I think that's the big question of, we need to listen to the evidence, how Origen presents it, but also when we look at what other people are saying, we need to see what is the way that they are saying this evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
Are they saying it just because they say it in a mean way or a way that does not approve of it doesn't necessarily mean we need to discount it, but we need to at least see the fact that it may not be an accurate portrayal
It's
what
not
Origen has said.
It's not necessarily going to give you an uncolored or, like, say, neutral take on what Origen is saying. It's going to give you a very positional, indeed polemical take on it. Okay.
Absolutely.
So let's leave Origen for the moment. That is, so in the recommended reading to this episode, I will give some examples of scholarship of people who say, nah, Origen did teach reincarnation. And then I think you're much more representative of, I'm gonna say, a scholarly mainstream that in one way or another takes a position that, no, he didn't.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll have some scholarship, obviously, that takes that position as well and discusses the issues. But you've laid them out very, very, very nicely for us here as well. My next question for you, the next thing I'd like to discuss, is precisely the specter of Origenism, whereby we have what Christian tradition, I guess, or what these sort of ecclesiastical writings and these eternal conclaves have painted as a Originist teaching tradition in antiquity from Origen through a bunch of people, but notably Didymus the Blind and Evagrius of Pontus. We haven't talked about Didymus much in the podcast. We have talked about Evagrius quite a bit. He's a very, very interesting esoteric Christian with a highly Platonist, metaphysically high-octane, metaphysical, speculative approach, but also just into the open-ended, hard-to-understand statement, which is a great way of writing theology or, you know, Christian spiritual manual, whatever you want to call it. We also have a lot of evidence that in the leading all the way up to the 5th century, so Justinian in the 6th century, there's no way he would have bothered and felt it so important to have this conclave condemning a bunch of points of what he called Originism if there hadn't been a lot of Originists around. We think that there were even maybe, I mean, it has been argued that there were maybe like manuals that traveled under the like theological sort of books or pamphlets or whatever that traveled under the name of Origen or maybe Evagrius or maybe, and they were not necessarily even anything from those authors. They were just the thoughts of monks and ascetics and stuff who were practicing this stuff. So very much in the Syriac milieu, especially in the Near East, there seems to have been a tradition. We can't say how big or how small, but of ascetics, like spiritual practitioners, who also were very into these speculative ideas, right? So that's our picture going into the 6th century. There is such a thing, there's a thing that its opponents will call Originism. I think its proponents will probably be calling it Christianity or the spiritual path or something along those lines, the scriptural way of life, who knows what they called it, but their opponents are calling it Originism. What is our evidence that that within this milieu, both the intellectuals who wrote books that we still have, like Evagrius, but also the anonymous monks who we know existed, but we can't say too much about what they believed, but they certainly were accused of believing in reincarnation. What can we say about this phenomenon in terms of the history of reincarnationism in Christianity?
Well, particularly when we look at the question of the distinction between Originist thought that is constructed by those who oppose it versus those that may hold Origen up as one of the chief commentators and exegetes of Christian thought. I think, as you've pointed out, and this is something that Elizabeth Clark, in her book on Originism, has really pointed out the fact that it doesn't have to match one-on-one with what is actually going on and being taught by the people, that it can be about contemporary discussions, contemporary concerns, that then Origen is seen as, and his followers are seen as, someone who is on the wrong side of interpretation. Now, that's a different question is when you look at the like Justinian and the letter to Menas, condemning the different teachings of Origen. As you've said, that opens up a different question,
right?
Of if these are the teachings of Origen, if you have a teachings of a figure, what they've actually said versus what their students remember from what they said or hold them to say is a different thing.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
And we know this with even like the Pythagorean tradition of this is what Pythagoras believed in this way. With Origen, we have the benefit of actually being able to go back to a written evidence and check. Broadly construed, if we want to say those who follow in the spirit of Origen, we see Eusebius as mm-hmm. being much, yeah. much praising of Origen. Gregory of Nyssa is within that same type of tradition. And Gregory the Wonder Worker, or Thaumaturgus in the Greek name, is also someone very much a student of Origen. Yeah. A self-proclaimed student. He wrote a very famous praise of Origen himself. Then we get those in the 4th century, like Rufinus and Pamphilus, who are very much aware that Origen's name has been a bit on the wrong side among certain people.
Yeah.
So they're very much wanting to promote that they themselves know that what Origen is teaching is okay.
Yeah.
And try to remove any doubt from the person himself of Origen.
Yeah.
And then with Jerome and Epiphanius, who's writing about what Origen was said to teach and things such as that, they will end up saying, no, this is not the case.
They make him into a heretic, basically.
They make him into a heretic. As to the Syriac tradition and those in the 6th century, I can't speak as much to that, but
it's hard to see why there would have been all this anti-Originist
yes.
polemic about these Syriac monks if there hadn't been some Originism among the Syriac monks. Now, what that looked like on the ground is another question, but it seemingly, someone was saying that humans reincarnate as serially.
Yes. And I think that's an example. It's good to try to see a group that is purported to believe to exist may align with actual people
mm-hmm.
who believe certain things, but they themselves may not identify with the labels that are given.
No, I'm sure they didn't.
I'm sure. And because we see with the Philokalia of Origen, the collection of his writings, and that's actually where we get a good deal of the Greek fragments for the On First Principles that I had mentioned are from this Philokalia. So we get the fact from the tradition, from the manuscript tradition, that Origen is someone who's definitely being read about, read from, excerpted. He's part of the everyday understanding.
Yeah.
But he's not necessarily.
But this is the thing, like let's say the Philokalia goes back to the Cappadocians, the Gregories. If it doesn't, it goes back to the 4th century somewhere, If Origen is writing in a period when Christianity, when it doesn't even make sense to talk about orthodoxy, there are many people pulling in many different directions to try to create something that will eventually be called orthodoxy. But
yes.
It's not been nailed down yet in any way that as an outsider, you can say, oh, those guys really were the orthodoxes. Obviously, as an insider, you can say, of course, the people who agreed with orthodoxy all along are the orthodox and everyone else. But that's a post factum thing. If Origen is anorthodox, not unorthodox, but anorthodox. Like the term orthodox is just irrelevant to discussing his thought mm-hmm. because of when he wrote. It's not so true anymore when the Cappadocians are writing and they're excerpting bits from Origen, which they think are this sort of spiritual gift for Christianity that needs to be excerpted and put into this Philokalia, which is still being read today, right?
Mm-hmm.
that's a process of possibly domestication or editing for the emerging mm-hmm. orthodoxy of the fourth century. Same thing with what Rufinus does in a different way of translating into Latin, but also just taking out a few bits that might kind of raise hackles or raise eyebrows. So there is a process on among intellectuals of seeing which way the wind is blowing in a given era and a given set of church authorities that they are beholden to, and going, okay, most of Origen is cool, but not these bits. We just quietly take them out. And so that we can see that happening, right? That mm-hmm. process. And that also, again, raises the specter of maybe Origen did just really talk about reincarnation. But setting that aside, because it isn't in our evidence explicitly, this tradition on the ground of what seems to have been not only quite a hardcore, ascetic, deeply spiritual practice of Christianity among the Syriac church in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries, but also deeply infused with some what would be considered heterodox beliefs by that point, because now you do have orthodoxy, and you know you do, because there are, like, the emperor is putting his stamp on documents coming from church councils, so that's the gold standard, right? There seems to be this tradition of reincarnationist belief among Christians, which is the thing that gets condemned as Originism, or, you know, one way it gets condemned. I guess my question for you would be, if that doesn't come from Origen, or, well, obviously Origen, one thing Origen clearly does is dive into the scriptures with a deeply Hellenic and Plato-infused way of thinking and come up with ways of reading the scriptures that are clearly influenced by that way of thinking, right? So he's a Hellenized Christian, or a Christian Hellenist, or a Christian Hellene, or a Christian Platonist, however you want to put it. But so just that way of thinking, setting an example of that as the kind of paradigmatic, cultured Christian way of doing scriptural exegesis, that obviously had a huge set a standard, and people followed that later on. And if you do that, you may come up with all manner of things that could be considered heterodox, right? But what I would ask you is, if these beliefs don't come from Origen, and I'm asking you now to speculate or refuse to speculate from a position of knowing the material, where would these ideas come from? Where do you think these reincarnationist monks are getting their ideas from? It's not an answerable by proof question. It's more of a, like, it would be interesting to know that, wouldn't it? What's going on with these reincarnationists?
It really would be. The only extent to which I would possibly speculate would be to think of the context in which these ideas first arose, and to think of the fact that now, by this point, it's a different situation. People are being born into the Christian tradition. It's not something that is, it's not necessarily by and large all taken over and eclipsed the pagan tradition. If we use pagan loosely, the Hellenic tradition of often polytheistic. But I think if we look at if we zoom out and look a little bit earlier, around the time of Origen,
third century,
we can see that the question of reincarnation has become such a popular concept that it doesn't really have one particular author that is associated with it. People get associated with the idea, but they themselves don't have to have written about it specifically to be put to it. I mean, if we even look back at Herodotus, he's saying the Egyptians have the reincarnate. This is where it came from. It came from the Egyptians. Not necessarily everybody goes back to that as an example, but that's just one example. Speculating on this, I would think, in lack of evidence, that we can see the topic itself being prompted by immediate concerns. Like if we look at Epiphanius, for instance, 4th century, there's enough of a polytheistic trend that's still around, or at least in the memory that's close to them, that when they're touching on this subject, they can really push for it within the lifetime of the individual. They understand and are aware in the cultural memory that this was a big thing of reincarnation. But I think one of the issues is that even if people stop believing in it, and there again, we don't necessarily have the evidence how widespread everyone was in thinking this, we have to realize that they are continuously, later readers are continuously going back to previous texts and would be finding it over and over and over. So if they are well read in the Greek tradition, for instance, they're going to continue going over and over looking at these things. If they're not as well read, perhaps, in the Greek tradition, and they go back to, let's say, Origen, Epiphanius, such as that, they are encountering someone who was aware of the topic well enough that they can encounter it firsthand in a secondhand fashion, if that makes sense. You know, they're firsthand readers of secondhand information.
Right. So in other words, they're living in a world where there is a lot of belief in reincarnation among polytheists. And and even if they don't have polytheist friends or whatever, it's a going concern. And you're saying later on, when it's becoming less and less of a going concern, although we must remember Olympiodorus is still teaching in the 6th century, and he's still a, you know.
At least professing. Let's just say maybe a less of a concern in the same fashion as it was in Origen's day.
Yeah.
For just stories here and there.
Yeah.
Of things.
But because people in the 6th century are reading Origen and others in the 3rd century, or let's forget about Origen, say earlier church fathers who just go hard against reincarnation in an unambiguous way. They're reading those guys. So that in their mind is creating a situation where Christians have to fight against reincarnation. Even in an era where potentially like hardly anyone believes in reincarnation anymore.
That's my speculation of what is going on. And another thing that scholars have really pointed out, we have with more of a standardization of what happens to the body after the body's death and what is entailed by the resurrection of the body, when that crystallizes, I think perhaps we could speculate to say that transmigration or reincarnation becomes a useful way of talking about what not to think about the body,
right,
or how to think about the body, as Elizabeth Clark is pointing out about those concerns of the body. It becomes something that's useful to talk about. But it doesn't necessarily even then mean that they themselves are believing such things. Now, there again, the evidence, as I've just said, with such an overwhelming evidence of Epiphanius says this, Justinian says this, Jerome says this, I don't necessarily have an answer on, do some people believe this?
Mm.
But at least what I see it is it's become such of a stock.
It's a trope.
Thought. It's a stock thought that at least people are aware of it. Contrasting often with how the resurrection actually comes into being.
Yeah.
So, which is the big thing, the fact that what ends up happening to the body? Because of the fact that you know that you will have the tenet, the well-formed doctrine of the body will have a resurrection. How is that different than transmigration?
Mm.
If we look at the way that it was described, and does it mean the specific body, like exact copy? Does it mean, as some thought earlier, a body that is cleansed of all imperfections?
Yeah.
You're
sort of, you're 18
that.
Years old, not a blemish on you, the prime of your life. But you presumably don't have a gender anymore, because there's that sort of, we're going to be like angels stuff in the New Testament. So you're going to have like sort of a Barbie crotch, I guess. There's no sex, and you're perfect somehow, I think. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It's a funny one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an open question specifically with that, but yeah, I was just to say that the speculation I would say is that I don't quite see it as fully being held
among Christians by the sixth century.
Among Christians. Yeah. Among Christians, I see the resurrection, yes, very much being held by Christians. But there again, I think, just as I mentioned with Jerome, the terms of the debate have changed.
Hmm.
And it's just some things are more, what may have been open for speculation in previous centuries, they've made more decisions of what is acceptable to talk about.
Yeah.
In writing.
I really appreciate your overview here. I'd like to push back on it with a few kind of thought experiments. The Nag Hammadi corpus dates to the 5th century, right? Now, that is a clear example of one place, and this is very plausibly thought by many to be a Christian monastery out in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
One place where they are reading the most heterodox, specifically condemned texts that since the 2nd century already. Irenaeus has, you know, a lot of the texts found in this library have been condemned by name by Irenaeus 300 years ago. They're reading all, they're collecting all this stuff. They're not burning it, so clearly someone's reading it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one out-of-the-way place in the Roman Empire where there's fervent Christians, literate Christians, who are spending a lot of time reading very, very difficult texts, which teach, among other things, reincarnation as one possible option.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not just heterodox. I mean, they're like Gnostic. They are
mm-hmm.
condemned on every level by all the developing orthodoxy. And this is the 5th century. This is a time when, if we trust what the Orthodox tell us from that period, orthodoxy is everywhere. And there's a few little pockets that need to be mm-hmm. dealt with. But basically, everyone's a Christian now, and we all agree with the Nicene Creed and blah, blah, blah. If we take that and think, okay, that can't have been the only place this was happening, and then we move in our mind's eye over to 5th century Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Constantinople, as we know, is not happy with what's going on in Syrian Christianity in general, partly because of Monophysitism, this sort of very obscure, difficult to understand argument over the precise nature of Christ. That's one thing. But there's also a lot of evidence from angry voices of orthodoxy coming from Constantinople and elsewhere that, let's say the Greek-speaking Roman Empire, that these Christians have lost the way. And one of the reasons, and there's tons of ways they've lost the way, but one of the things is they're teaching heretical, horrible doctrines like reincarnation. That doesn't sound implausible to me at all. In fact, that's, if we didn't have the Nag Hammadi library, and you mm-hmm. said, okay, in the 5th century, there's a monastery in Egypt, and they have, like, they're reading the Hermetica and Plato and the Apocryphon of John and all these, like, hardcore Gnostic metaphysico-religious texts, I would have said, nah, that doesn't sound very plausible. But we found it, so we know it is plausible. In fact, it's true. So if I'm thinking about, you know, plausibility in this sort of irresponsible, speculative mm-hmm. way, I can feel like, yeah, hell yeah, I'm sure these Syriac monks were getting up to all manner of crazy ass speculations. out there in the desert having visions, not eating enough, doing programmatic spiritual exercises of an extremely rigorous nature, not having sex, like all just men hanging out with other men, women hanging out with other women. Like that's a kind of the sort of cultural pressure cooker that leads to exuberant flowering of interesting doctrines, right? So I can see, I'm not saying this is the case, but I could see whole troops of smelly ascetics in the Syrian desert who are arguing for a very kind of like recognizably Platonistic system of reincarnation that they somehow also have a resurrection body at the end of the cycle. There's some, you know, there's some way they integrate it with a Christian eschatology. Seems very, very plausible to me. And they could have been tons of them. That's what I'm saying. Like it might not even be like five dudes. We might be talking about potentially thousands. We might be talking about churches where they preach, or even if they don't preach reincarnation, where the whole congregation understands that that's what happens when you die. You're reborn in another body. That's the Christian teaching. Like, why not? That's what the opponents are saying. They're saying these people are teaching, spreading this false doctrine throughout Syria and so on. If you kind of add up all these condemnations, that's kind of the picture you get. Why not just think, yeah, that's probably true?
I mean, that is a good point. The fact is, just to talk more mainly about the evidence with the Nag Hammadi of that time period, that has been very difficult to try to understand when this those texts, as the collection is, came into being.
Indeed.
You know, it's clear that they're from a later date in Coptic. Mm-hmm. So we know definitely working backwards that people are reading them. That they, and as you were saying with Plato as well, the Nag Hammadi corpus does have a part of Plato within the text in Coptic. And as you're saying, they're a very widely a potpourri of varying points of view, even within the text. It's, as we have it, we think of it often as one text, but you know, the collection as we have. So in that way, that does fit our point of view of what we have from later authors talking about the subject of reincarnation. There may have been other texts that we just don't have that were available elsewhere. It's one of those things that Egypt, in particular for documents, is very good at preserving them because of the dry desert.
Yeah, you always have to correct for Egypt
when
thinking about antiquity.
Yes. So in that way, I can definitely see someone reading these texts without necessarily... I can think of two particular ways. We don't have enough evidence fully, if we're going to use the word Gnostic, to talk about who these people were.
No. I don't want to talk about Gnostic. And, like, forget about the Gnostics. The only reason I even use that term without defining what I meant is these texts, some of these texts, like the Apocryphon of John and others, are precisely the texts that are condemned by Irenaeus as being texts of the Gnostics. So from the perspective of an Orthodox crusader against heresy, voila, the Gnostic texts. I'm not saying anything about what these people called themselves. My feeling is the vast majority of them called themselves Christians, but that's another story.
I think so. And I think so. So, I mean, the issue is that the evidence until the discovery of the Nag Hammadi was such that we only had people such as Irenaeus to talk about it, or Plotinus even, but and arguably Celsus in the way that he's describing things as well as Origen presents it.
Yeah.
And Origen himself against
Origen himself and let's say Clement.
Yes.
In a troubling way, because Clement is of course the one ancient Christian, early Christian, who does in his extant work say, I am a Gnostic.
Yes. Yes. As someone who knows with Gnosis.
Yeah. And that there's an inner circle of Christians who have Gnosis. It's okay if you don't, but really the hardcore Christians are the ones with gnosis. So he is a Gnostic in that sense. So throwing that in there.
So, I mean, if we think about it, yes, the Nag Hammadi has repeated incarnations of the body, reincarnation. I mean, the whole premise is that we once were not embodied. We once were disembodied, now we've become into a body, broadly speaking, across the corpus. So in absence of knowing exactly what is going on among those who generate these texts, those who hold these texts dear, and what has become of them at the time that this particular version, this particular edition, was produced in Coptic at that monastery, that's a different question of, are they encountering people who believe in this reincarnation? But as you're saying, yes, they're reading it.
Yeah.
They're reading these texts. And so definitely, I think that we could try to explore to what extent, when they're reading these, is the act of reading it being considered approving it?
Right.
Even. At least those, the detractors would probably say so. But even if we go to the way that Plato's texts were debates of how they were supposed to be read.
Yeah.
You can read a text and it does not necessarily have to have what is written in the text to say that the text says something. If enough people think that a text has something, they can do it.
Yeah, for sure.
So
I'm with you. And another another thing is that a lot of these so-called Gnostic texts, like the Apocrypha of John, the hypostasis of the Archons, et cetera, they all lay out a very, very detailed metaphysics or mythology, whatever you want to call it, like with eons and sub-eons and light bodies.
Sophia,
all that stuff. But they all, and they're all really detailed, and they all totally differ from each other. So it's like to believe that a Gnostic is reading these and genuinely takes this to be the gospel truth, well, they can't, because they're all mutually contradictory. So what if they do read this collection, this broad spectrum of works, and take them all to be the truth, they must be reading it in such a way that you don't have to take it literally. That's the only way to make sense of all of these mutually contradictory mythological origin stories.
And to use another pun when we're talking about origin stories, to think of Origen himself, on this particular topic, let's look at Genesis itself, which many of these Nag Hammadi texts are taking the account of Genesis in some way and running with it.
Yeah, they're very
different
interested
perspective,
in it.
Like On the Origin of the World really presents a scenario that looks at it from another point of view of what the account that has come into from the Hebrew and then into the Septuagint. So if we look in that particular question, look at Origen himself, later people will say in the Genesis account where humans have committed their first sin, and as a result of that, Adam and Eve are aware that they don't have clothing. And then God fashions rudimentary clothing for them, coats of skin, as often as one rough way of describing it. So that big question, as later interpreters held as a big problem, does this mean that we actually, as humans, just didn't have clothes and then put clothes on? Or
does it mean that we put bodies on, physical bodies?
Did we put bodies on?
Yeah.
So I think often where we're going to find the questions of the reincarnation or question about reincarnation, we may be used to looking for it as what happens after you die. But I think a lot of people in some ways were having it, well, what happened to you before you were born?
Word.
You know, if you think of it on the front end of it, of what happened before then. And with Origen himself, this is a big question among scholarship of, did the soul originally have no body and then becomes a body? And is that the interpretation? My reading is that if we go with Origen specifically, he always thinks we have to have a body.
Yeah, well, that would imply that if he did teach pre-existence, then we come from, perhaps, the resurrection body, right? Or something analogous to it.
Potentially in that case, and it may just be the return to our previous existence
then,
in that way.
Which then allows you to just say, and then what if you just repeat that process? Reincarnation, done. And resurrection body integrated beautifully with the reincarnation process. This also allows you to integrate Origen's ideas about a kind of like an angelic existence that we used to have, followed by a fall, right? Which he hints at, where we somehow weren't quite content being so close to God. We got curious or whatever, and then ended up becoming embodied in matter. It's not hard to see, even if that isn't Origen's teaching, it's not hard to see exegetes going, ah, I know what Origen was talking about.
Absolutely. And so I'm thinking, when we look at that particular question from that angle, you can definitely see, as I've said before, where some of the detractors are getting their accusations or the stuff they don't like that they say Origen believed. It's in the text, to some extent, the subject matter.
Yeah.
But the picture is being drawn by those later of, and I would say, regardless specifically of what Origen is saying on that point, which, although as I think he himself is thinking that there always has to be the body, whether or not this cyclical process is actually occurring, you know, that's a thing to ask for future research. Perhaps not what he is envisioning. Yeah. I usually see it as myself as one that's one particular way of reading it. If you don't have this cyclical aspect with it. But as you're pointing out, yes, you can.
Yeah.
Potentially read that into the text without violating any of the Christian doctrines broadly construed of other bodies, meaning a different identity than yours, or a different being than yours. I mean, we can really mince up the words here. It's almost like the ship of Theseus in a way.
Right.
Like at what point, in the metaphor of if you keep replacing something, you have the ship, is it still the same ship?
Mm-hmm.
So the question that way, when you then go to the biblical text, you have a standard to which everyone is reading this Greek text or native language, if at this point there's some proliferation in the translation. So they agree with that.
Yeah.
But what that actually means behind it is a different thing, specifically. In that speculation, I would say potentially, in that point of view, I could see someone reading it. But as is construed among Origen himself, as what is being taught among Hellenic audiences, to whatever extent they themselves are even thinking this, I don't think that's probably what's going on in here. It's tied, as you're saying, with the resurrection body, with how the soul comes to be united with the body to begin with, and ultimately, how do we interpret Genesis of the creation of the entire humanity?
And as we know from the Jewish tradition as well, speculation about what Genesis really means is the key locus for esoteric interpretation in the Abrahamic faith. It's like the minute you say it's not literally what happened, literally, like, and you can just start asking questions like, well, if God made them clothes, why did he make them crappy clothes? Like, why didn't he make them really nice clothes? You know, like all these little niggling things that if you approach it literally don't make any sense. Why does he have to do it on multiple days? Like, I thought he was omnipotent. Why 7 days? Like, what's going on there?
Yes.
Those, so the minute you open the door to saying, well, it must not mean exactly what it means on the surface text, you can get into some pretty profound and pretty bizarre and pretty crazy speculation. We will see this in the Jewish tradition with Kabbalah, where the Ma'asa Bereshit, like the speculations about Bereshit, the first book of the book of Genesis, are the most esoteric matters that can only be dealt with by like the true sages who've already done a lifetime of Torah study and speculation. And similarly, I'd say in Christianity, it again and again, it has flowered as a place that has to be dealt with inestimable caution and, speculative nuance. We all agreed it can't be exactly literal because that just doesn't make any sense. But what can we get away with and all this kind of stuff? It's a motor. It's a motor for generating interesting anthropologies and theologies and creation stories.
And just to point back with what's going on in the wider tradition, we see an analogous trend with the Timaeus of Plato.
Yeah.
And those who are very much commenting on the Timaeus as an account of the world's beginning.
Yeah.
So it's not just a Jewish or Christian springboard. The idea of how did the world begin was very important.
Yeah.
And if we go also, just to mention briefly, we haven't mentioned him, I don't think, in this conversation, but Philo, potentially. As you were saying about the text with Genesis itself, with Philo notices the fact that there are two creation accounts within Genesis in the opening part of the text.
Right.
And they don't necessarily line up with one another.
Yeah.
And so we already have a precedent with Philo that we have to explain this.
Yeah.
We have to explain, does this mean two different types of creation? And then you can definitely kind of see how with Origen, this is an important precursor, even if he doesn't take that directly head on, you can see how it would be a springboard. And then later people would want to address this as well. And it's a big question of, does the text itself lend itself to multiple interpretations? And among ancient Christians, yes.
Yeah.
And among, as it goes on, yes. And that's part of the issue of why they're talking even more to try to narrow it down a bit.
Yeah, yeah. You can. We need multiple interpretations, but not too many, for God's sake. Yeah. Rein it in, fellas.
Yeah.
All right. Jonathan Young, thank you so much for presenting us with a very Originian, open-ended take on Origen and the question of reincarnation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Until we have the good fortune to speak again, I invite you to be like Origen's actual opinion on the matter of serial reincarnation and stay esoteric.